tonight's share is right now. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Frankie. My name's Adam. I'm a recovering addict.
Hi.
This is a bit of a surprise to me. Ollie talked to me on Tuesday and said, would I come and share? And I said yes, because that's what one does. And then it's gradually realised where I am and what I'm supposed to be doing. I'll just talk a bit closer.
Then I can hear you in the background.
Okay, very good. Can you all hear me now?
Fantastic. Thank you.
I've been doing this, not this particular thing, talking to this microphone, but this business of recovery for many years now. I came in 85, and I've managed to stay clean a day at a time since then. And I'm extremely pleased about that on a daily basis. And I was 35 when I came in, so I'm 60 now, for those of you who can't add. And, it's like having a second life, you know, is what's happened to me. You know, I had my first life, which you know, had its little ups and a hell of a lot of downs, you know, in its time. And then I had a second life. I was given a second chance because of Narcotics Anonymous, not because of anything else. You know, NA changed my life. You know, I grew up in London and Sussex. My parents separated when I was very young. They were both middle class. There was no particular hardship in our story, in my story. They just, you know, they didn't like each other, and they treated me strangely, and I had a weird time, and I didn't feel like a child. I never felt like a child, you know. I felt more like a child at the age of 35 and a half than I did at, you know, the age of three. you know how that is. The thing is, right, is that I was allowed to drift. I wasn't given boundaries by my parents because they felt guilty because they weren't proper parents and they, you know, la la la, all that stuff I know. And you know, I know about them now, you know. And I don't want to complain about them, actually. They just did what they did. And they did the best they could under the circumstances, whatever that was. You know, they came from a weird place. I was born in 1950, which was a strange time. And, you know, I started taking acid when I was 15. And I started taking heroin when I was about 16 and a half. You know, so I had a pretty strange time in my late teens, you know, because it was, you know, it was the psychedelic era. So, you know, there was all that happening. And, you know, I was completely crazy, you know. I was saved in some way, but briefly, by a relative who said, why don't you go to college and study something? And for some reason I did. I don't know why that is. There's a couple of things happened to me in my first 35 years that were like, you know, somebody reaching out and saying, why don't you do this? You know, that managed to keep me going. That I know, looking back, because I know my history really well now. I've had a lot of time to think about it. And, you know, I know there were points where I wouldn't have made it. I absolutely would not have. And if I hadn't gone to college, then I would have carried on with the acid and the smack, and there was no way. There was no way I'd shoot anything, you know. Anything, it didn't matter what, as long as I could get it in the needle and get it in my arm, I'd shoot it. And it was hell, you know, because you know what happens. Some of you know what that's like. You know, needle addiction is vile. And because I started studying stuff and started thinking, and you know, a woman I was with got pregnant, is the other thing that happened, you know. And and I married her, so I arrived with a degree, married, and a bad addiction problem. So because of the child thing, because it touched me, it was the second time something happened to me. The child thing touched me. So I found a way of surviving, which was to do with cocaine and booze, which, you know, our friend was talking about here. And it's a profound addiction, and it allows for quite a lot of activity. You know, if you're careful, you can manage. And I managed like that in the entertainment industry as a technician, not as anything exciting. Until I was 35. It got worse and worse and worse. You know, I was intelligent and bright, and I could do my job, but I was disabled by my addiction, which I controlled rigidly so that I wouldn't use. Some of the days I wouldn't use until 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It was nightmare, you know. All this stuff, you know, just to have a life. So I thought I was having a life. I thought this was it. I thought that I'd screwed myself up by taking this acid and smack when I was young and not having a proper childhood. And I'd worked all this out for myself, you know, some weird kind of little fable I'd given myself about myself. You know, I mutated my genes and, you know, so I've ended up in this weird condition and this is the only kind of life I can have. So I need to do this stuff, you know. And sometimes I'd need to get a drink first thing in the morning because I couldn't manage and, you know, all this, you know. And I thought nobody knew. That's the other thing about it. You know, I thought nobody knew and I must have looked like hell, you know. I'd come out of my office when I worked in Covent Garden. I'd come out of my office and I'd go and have a drink and I'd wake up on the pavement, you know, at 11 o'clock. You know, and I think that was okay. You know, and I've been there since 5:30. And you know, all this stuff went on. And eventually I became completely what they call topped up. So that is, I couldn't drink more than 1/2 pint of lager a day and I couldn't snort more than 1/2 line a day. And that was it. But after that point, I became toxicified or whatever the expression is. And I would start to fit or go weird or something like that. You know, and I was kind of trudging through my life. God knows why these people still gave me a job. I mean, I don't understand that at all, you know. And I was kind of, you know, just kind of working my way through my day was like unbelievable, you know, with this strange condition I was in that I could hardly move. Anyway, cut a long story short, an old girlfriend got me into treatment. It was a flash place in Hampstead. Nice. And I thought they put me on the doctors talked to me and said, you know, you're lucky to be here, and this is what we're going to do to detox you. And it went on for 2 weeks, and I had anti-fit and this, that, and the other. And they shot me up with stuff, and gradually they got rid of the poison to the extent that I could start speaking properly. And I was in a bad way, you know, and so I started going to the, you know, groups and seeing the psychiatrists and all this, and I thought, this is great, you know, and this is easy because I can say anything to these guys. My mother used to work for an eminent psychoanalyst. I knew all the talk. It was easy. I thought, this is great. I worked out how to, what I discovered was called comply my way through treatment, you know, and this was easy street for me. Now, the thing that, and then they said, oh, you got to go to an AA meeting, and I thought, I know all about AA meetings, you know, you talk about the booze and leave. You know, you can't talk about the drugs, so don't talk about the drugs and leave. So I did that. Then they said, you're going to an NA meeting. And I said, what's that? And they said, it's in the garden, right? And in the garden of this treatment centre was a porter cabin. And in the porter cabin, once a week, was an NA meeting. It was quite well known in its day, because there were only 8 meetings or 9 meetings or something, weren't there? And, you know, and I walked in there, and my life changed. At that point, at the age of 35, completely, utterly, and totally, and has never been the same. Because what happened to me was there was about, I don't know, what, 14, 15 people in the room. It was raining outside, so it smelled of, you know, wet overcoat and stuff like that. I could smell it today. And I saw people in there, and they started talking, and I realized that there were people like me. And that was the first time that I could ever remember thinking that. You know, I mean, I had a brother, he was schizophrenic, still is actually, and so he was my sibling, right? And he was completely, irreconcilably potty, you know, and that was as close as I had, the closest person I'd ever had in my life, you know. I had no connection with the woman I married, you know. I had this connection with my child, she was my child, you know. I had nobody like me, I thought I was the only one. That's why NA changed my life, because I'm just like you. And that's a fact. And I knew that a few days later. I realized there were loads of us, you know, and there were going to be loads more of us. That's the other thing we knew, wasn't it? Is that there were only a few of us at the time, but it was really, really obvious, because every day it got bigger. Every day there was another meeting, you know, and it became really obvious, because we found out what was going on in the States. They had a world convention in Wembley, you know, about 18 months later. It was a big thing. And it was a big movement to be part of. And you couldn't be part of it unless it was working. And that's the thing. That's the message. There actually isn't much. It's the most important message. The most important thing that happened to me is step 2. And it still happens. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. We came to believe that because we came here. And we kept coming here. And when we first came here, we felt like shit. And when we came the second time, we felt slightly better, but still like shit, because we felt slightly better because we knew somebody. And so on. And the tea tasted slightly better the fourth time. These things, you know, and you're stumbling around, you're thinking, Christ, what the hell's this? This is my life. What's happened here? You know, and then gradually, you know, people say, you'll feel better. And you think, yeah, bollocks. But you do feel better, despite yourself. If you keep coming, a day at a time, you will feel better. You do feel better. And gradually, you get restored to sanity. And the sanity you get restored to is one you've never known. I guarantee it. You've never known it. Because otherwise you wouldn't be here. Because I know who you are because I'm like you. Right? And actually, that's all I've really done. You know, there's loads to it. You know, there's loads of stuff. There's traditions, there's steps, there's all this stuff. But the fact is, I came here and I was restored to sanity a day at a time by the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous. The conscious contact, the contact with my higher power is brought about by being with you guys. Not by wandering about and getting some bright light from the sky in the middle of the night. You know, it's from you lot. It doesn't matter how you see your higher power. In my view, this is a personal opinion, but I really don't think it matters. You know, that I hear a lot of this. I mean, I went to AA a long time before I got into recovery, and one of the reasons I walked away was because of the God thing. And you know why? Because I was looking for the differences. That's why. And what do we say? You know, look for the similarities, not the differences. It should be on the wall. Should be written on your hand for the first 2 years. Shouldn't it? It's true. You know, because that's it. You know, I walked into AA, I thought, all right, they're all piss heads and they believe in God. I'm out. You know, notwithstanding the fact I'd drunk enough to sink a battleship in my time. You know, forget all that, no. You know, they're different. They haven't done the acid and smack thing, or they haven't done the mandrax thing, or they haven't done this thing. And I hear it, and I've heard it for 25 years. I hear people come in and say, well, I'm not quite like, you know, because I just did dope, or I just did prescribed drugs, or I just did, you know. We had a guy the other day scraped something off the Nurofen Plus, you know, was how he'd been, you know, surviving. You know, what's the difference? There is no difference. The only difference is the condition you're now in physically, because you may have fucked yourself up really badly, or you may not have, in which case you're lucky. Because it, you know, you can use anything. Like she says, you can use anything. And my addiction started in the same way. I nicked stuff, you know, I never had enough. I still don't have enough. You know, I still find myself, you know. That's why we have a step 10. That's what it's about. Take your inventory. Think about what you're thinking. What did you just think? You just thought, oh, I could do with some more money. You got enough money, probably. You know, if you've come here for a few years, you know, and you've stayed clean, you've probably got enough money, actually. You know, think about where you've been. You know, I remember, like it was yesterday, stumbling along the road to my job when I could just get there. Just. And what the fuck did I think I was doing? I didn't know what else to do. I thought that was life. That wasn't life. You know, this is life. I'm having a life now. You know. And it's a real life. And it's because of you lot. It's because of coming here a day at a time. I did 90 meetings in 90 days and then I did another 90. And I had sponsors and I bloody hated them. You know, because I can't stand being told what to do. You know, why on earth should I put up with that? What do you mean? You know, don't go out with women. Don't do this. Don't do that. You know, I'm clean now. You know, and some of the mistakes, some of the mistakes you just got to make yourself, you know, in my book, you know, you just make them, and that's what happens. You feel like shit, you know. The business is learning how to survive a day at a time by coming to meetings, learning how to cope with the feelings as they arrive, because they're not there to begin with, whatever you think. You know, whatever anybody says, I don't care whether you're a man or a woman, you don't know what feelings are when you come in here, you know, and gradually it comes back. And depending on your age and experience, you know, it's how you deal with them and what happens then, you know. And all sorts of things. You know, feelings make you do weird things. And, you know, feelings make you go strange. They make you form associations with people that perhaps you shouldn't. You know, yeah, all this stuff, you know. Well, it's true, you know, and some of it's part of learning, and some of it's fucking dangerous, frankly, excuse my language, you know, and that's why you have a sponsor, to tell you the difference. I didn't get that at all. I got, you have a sponsor to tell you what to do, period, so I'm not going to tell you what I don't want to tell you, and that's that. And it took ages to understand that you're as sick as your secrets. I didn't get that at all. I thought, yeah, okay, I'm sick as my secrets, but some of my secrets are my business. So, you know, and I don't know who else thinks like that, you know. How come that's okay? You know, but there I was, you know. Oh, yeah, okay, well, I'm just not going to tell you that stuff because it's okay. And then, you know, I'm on the bloody edge thinking about jacking up for the first time in 20 years, you know. Because I haven't told him about some girl I'm going out with or something that's happening, you know, some money thing, this, that thing. You got to tell him everything. If it makes you uncomfortable, it's not okay. If it makes you uncomfortable, you're doing something, you're thinking something that makes you uncomfortable, you got to tell somebody right now. Well, not right now, but, you know, shortly. I'm not kidding. You know, this stuff will kill you. You know, and there it is in the back of your mind. You're thinking, well, yeah, maybe he, you know, but you know, so what? He just says that. I know. I watch loads of people relapse. I've been to the same meeting for 24 years in another part of London. Every Tuesday, I go to a meeting. 24 years. For a long time, I went to a meeting every day, and then I went to 4 meetings a week. Now I get to 1 a week, sometimes 1 more. Okay, but I go, right? And people come and go. And I hear them, I watch them, and I listen to them. And some of them go out because they get flesh with it. Get a bit of money, car, job, wife. It's a men's meeting. You know. Clothes. And they're back in the Kensington scene, Jack the Lad, you know. And they're out. And they don't, oh, well, I don't need to go there, and it's humiliating to talk about with my mates. You know, I don't want to, you know. And they're down. They start with a drink, a glass of wine. Well, wine's okay. And they're straight down the tube. Straight down the tube, straight back to whatever it is brought them in. You know, smack, Nurofen, Mandrax, whatever the fuck it was, they're back on it. You know, and it's hell. It's not, I mean, I only did it once. You know, my history, not worth it. You know, I went out there, I'd fucking, you know, God knows what had happened to me, and I'd be very lucky to get back, you know. But I watch people go out, and they have a hell of a time getting back in. And they go out because they're thinking for themselves, and they're not sharing. You know, if you haven't got a sponsor, open your mouth in a meeting, go to a meeting, and share your stuff. And then talk to somebody afterwards, and then get a sponsor. Because there's no substitute for this stuff. There's no substitute for the truth. You know, the truth will make you better. You don't have to tell a doctor. You don't have to tell a professional. Whatever they say. You don't have to tell anybody but another addict. Because another addict knows. You know, there is no shame. There is no risk in talking to another addict about the stuff that bothers you. And if you don't, you'll use. It's a fact. And we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity because we are restored to sanity. This is it, boys and girls. This is what we call sanity. Bizarre though it might seem, but, you know, spend some time on the tube. You know, I've got to tell you, you know, this seems pretty sane to me, some of the stuff you see, especially in this town. You know, you wander about at midnight. Well, don't, you know, not by yourself. But you know what I'm saying? There's a lot of madness out there. Worrying about what sanity is not the point. Oh, well, I seem to be on one tonight. Okay, so wildest dreams we'll talk about, right? There's all sorts of versions of this one. They say make a list, you know, make a list of what you want. And in a few years' time, you read the list. Yeah, I got all that. Actually, what we're talking about is beyond your wildest dreams. This is as she says, beyond your wildest dreams. What's on offer is beyond your wildest dreams. Because, well, I mean, speaking for myself, I couldn't bloody well dream about anything when I came in here apart from where I was going to get my next, you know, drug or drink from. You know, so then it was, you know, my wildest dreams were, my dreams were about, you know, staying sober a day at a time, staying clean a day at a time, you know, not using, trying to make a living. You know, I found, my daughter was 13 when I came into recovery, and the responsibility I found overwhelming, frankly. You know, I was 35, you know, I hadn't paid a lot of attention to her. I knew her well, but only in a kind of passing, kind of elder brothery kind of way. You know, pretend fatherhood, we call that. You know, parenting is an excruciatingly complicated and heart-rending business. You know, and those of you who know exactly what I'm talking about. And those of you who don't know, if you're in early recovery, I suggest you don't find out for a while. You know, don't get me wrong. I have two children. One's 36 and she has two children of her own, and the other one's 19. And they are my greatest achievement, frankly. You know, they really are. I have nothing further. I've done a lot work-wise. A lot of, some of it exciting, some of it not so exciting. I really am not concerned with any kind of legacy, concerned with my work because of my children. I don't have that. I have these children. I brought them up to the best of my ability. I made my amends to my daughter by bringing her up properly from the age of 13, and she got through her drug taking, and, you know, and she became an ordinary person because I loved her. Because she didn't have it that badly, and I loved her. And our boy could easily be an addict, but he's not, because his parents love him and they've stayed together, despite the occasional argument. And, you know, and he's okay, and he'll have a good life, you know. And that's my amend to my childhood, if you like. Look, the thing about this stuff is that somewhere inside you, you carry some grief about your lost childhood, right? And I'll try to be brief about this because it's on my mind a touch, so I'm going to share about it. You know, the fact is that we're here because we were a fuck-up of some description, that we took too many drugs, that we made a fucking complete mess of everything, you know, by consuming and consuming. Maybe we were in a horrible situation with our parenting. Maybe we were in some kind of revolting gang of some description where we had to throw stuff down. But actually, what it is we've got a genetic predisposition to addiction. And that makes us socially very, very, very difficult people while we are using. And as a consequence, we don't lead normal lives until we come here and get better a day at a time and get restored to sanity. So what that means is that at some point in our recovery, we're going to come across a grief for ourselves. An unbearable sadness. And this has happened to me on about three occasions, to a more profound extent, the cleaner that I've been when it's happened to me. You know, in group one day, I completely fell apart and I couldn't stop crying because it was a family group and all the families had turned up and nobody had come for me, poor me. So I was in bits. You know, and later on, when I was about 5 years clean, a similar thing happened to me. And I just had a good sponsor, I got held and I got through it, you know, and I needed to do it. And that's the thing. I tell you about my experience because it happened to me, because step four is about writing it down. You know, I think it's easy to get distracted in step four by the resentment side of things. And I think it's very important, don't get me wrong, I just also think it's important to understand how you feel about who you were. Because that's the time you're going to write it down. And it's you writing it, it's not somebody else. It's your life. And then you have to share it with another human being. And that is a startling process, as some of you know. That is outrageous. I don't regret a moment of it. But after it, I was in shock. Because somebody else knew all my stuff. And I knew it too. I'd said it out loud. I'd read my life story, my life history, my feelings about who I was, all my nasty little dealings, all my failings with my daughter and my ex-wife and all this stuff, and I'd read it out loud, and I felt like hell for a year. You know, in a way, deep inside, I felt like hell, and I wouldn't talk about it. I couldn't, because it was too painful, you know, because of what it meant. It meant, what does this mean? That my life started when I was 35? That all that was a waste of time? You know, what does that mean? That I've only got this half life, the half a life, instead of a whole life? Look, it's either half empty or it's half full, folks. That's it. You know, and that's the news. You know, and I suggest that for us lot, it's half full, because we have hope. We have these meetings a day at a time. We have the ability to get better a day at a time. We have the ability to recover from the disease of addiction, which has somehow been inflicted upon us, a day at a time. You know, and that's the news. And the news is, look around. The news is all around you. It's people getting better, people going to work, people leading their lives. I worried at about, I don't know, God knows, maybe 4 or 5 something, 7 years clean, something like that, that I was boring. For some reason, I thought that I hadn't been boring beforehand. Really? You know, I actually thought I was an interesting person while I was using all this shit. You know, anyway, you know, I thought it was boring. I thought it was going to be boring. I thought it was all going to be boring. And this just goes on and on and on, right? I just do this stuff and I get a job and I get, you know, what happens? And I get married and I have a kid and, you know, and I get, what do I do? I get a semi in Bromley and what, you know, and or get a Cortina or whatever it is, Fiesta or whatever, you know. Same old, same old. It isn't like that for us, is it, really? You know, because we're not the same. We're not Mr. and Mrs. Average. It just isn't like that. It never was and it isn't now. You know, and actually, what one worries about, you know, that thing about feeling that you're boring is a denial system. It's your addiction talking to you. And I say that, and I can say you. I mean, you're supposed to, you know, talk about one's own experience. I only say you because I know it to be a fact. I have listened to my addiction driveling on inside my head periodically for many years. Right? Oh, well, you shouldn't be doing that. That's far too dull. You know, it's my wife's birthday, right? You know, it's just, it's tough. Life, ordinary stuff is sometimes tough for us. That's all. We ran away from it in the first place. We couldn't identify with it in the first place. It wasn't on the cards for us in the first place. And it is now. That's what being restored to sanity means. It means you can have an ordinary life. And an ordinary life is fantastic. There isn't anything else, actually. You know, God knows that kind of weird society that we've been brought into, a weird time of, in society where, you know, everything's on it. You know, the science fiction, the mad movies and all this, and everybody, you know, you watch this, all this fantasy unfolding on television and on the papers and in the cinema and all this, and you kind of, and because we've come from a weird place, it's quite hard to realise that actually the point of life is to have an ordinary time. You know. Well, it's true, isn't it? There isn't anything else. You know, just have an ordinary time. You know, have friends. Love your friends. Have family. Love your family. Help your parents. Be helped by your children if you're getting that way. Maybe. You know. I'm overstating the fact, you know, and I don't mean to be. It's just that I'm aware that you know, we think that there's a business about taking drugs in the first instance, which is kind of zippy. You know, it's kind of trendy and exciting. There's a frisson to it. You think you're doing something. It's not. It's the nature of the chemical. It's nothing to do with reality, but it is what we think, you know. And I suppose the point I'm making is that it's an illusion. It's your addiction talking. It's the chemical talking to you. So, you know, actually, what you have to do is look at the other side. And the other side of the coin is ordinary life is great. You know, the sun shines, it's bloody great. It rains, you know. You can have holidays. You can have children. You can have pets. They're all good things. They're just ordinary things and they're great. You know, enjoy them. That's the thing, because in themselves they are the stuff of life. This is it. This is all there is. You know, and it's good stuff. It isn't to me, it isn't, I don't mean to demean it by saying that. By saying this is all there is, I don't mean to demean it. I think it's a celebration because it's enough to know. You know, the thing is, we tend to think that there's something more. You know, okay, 12 steps, yeah, what's next? There isn't anything else. There isn't anything else. 1 to 12, that's it. You can start again if you like. But actually, you know, they're it. The steps are for living. They're not, it's not a study. It's not a degree. You know, they are, all of life is in there. If you don't understand it, read it again. You know, it's not, you know, they're not the Ten Commandments brought down from the fucking mountaintop. They are, you know, they're written by a bunch of alcoholics who are slightly out of date now. So, you know, some of it sounds a bit funny, but that's just the language. It's actually the facts. They are the facts. That's how to recover from the disease of addiction. That's it. That's all there is. You know. But we can't do it alone. That's the thing. Cannot do it alone. That's why we're here. Addict alone, you all know the story. You know. Don't spend any time in your head if it's bad. Don't spend any time in your own company if it's bad. That means go to a meeting. Phone a friend, find a friend, go to a meeting. You know, do it a day at a time until it gets better. Then do it every other day. There's nothing else. And it's all here. And you, I guarantee, if you stay clean a day at a time in the fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous and come to meetings, you will be restored to sanity. There is no doubt in my mind because I've seen it thousands of times. You know. And the proof's in the pudding. That's what I love about step two, is it's incontrovertible. I didn't have to subscribe to some bizarre religion in order to get well here. All I had to do was go to the meetings and it happened to me. That's a fact. It didn't matter what I was thinking. Bloody Buddhists, bloody Christians, bloody this. You know, didn't matter what was going on in my head. You know, I got well. I got restored to sanity because I came here. You know, and that's the message. And that'll do. Thanks.